There was a time when if you had told a wine expert that there could be a superb Pinot Noir coming out of Oregon, you would have been laughed out the door. You probably know that today those wines are routinely compared to the great Burgundies of France. Well, one man started this off in the Willamette Valley 50 years ago. In 1965, David Lett did what many thought was insane. He and his wife, Diana, spent their honeymoon planting the first Pinot Noir grapes in the Willamette Valley. They were creating their Eyrie Vineyard, which now has cult status. David had a reputation for being a firebrand and a stubborn traditionalist, and of course, a visionary. He rarely gave interviews, but before his death in 2008, he invited us into his home, and we were thrilled. After all the success, the Letts still lived in a real house tucked into the vineyard with those original vines planted right outside the living room door. David was seated in a chair in the living room. His health had been failing, and he was tethered to an oxygen tank. Though he struggled at times, his eyes were bright and alive. His son, Jason, pulled up a chair and joined us. David, going back to those days when you were studying at University of California at Davis, which is, I always think of it as it's sort of the Harvard of wine. What were you drinking back then when you started to fall in love with Pinot Noir? Because we're talking the 60s, right? The early 60s.
Yeah, there were very few Pinots in California. So the curriculum was primarily based on French Burgundy. And that was my introduction to Pinot Noir, and that's what turned me on to Pinot Noir. They were ethereal. It evoked so much in yourself that it was truly an exciting wine to drink. And this was back in the days when Pinot Noir was made quite differently in Burgundy than it is now. Thank God. It was a nice wine. They're messing around with it a little too much in Burgundy these days.
So what you're emulating here are those wines that you were drinking early on, those ethereal, soul-touching, if I could coin a phrase, wines.
I am trying to. But I've stuck to what I started with, and that is a Burgundian ideal of the 1960s.
You came here in 1966, and you planted Pinot Noir grapes. And you came here from California. You could have, in those days, gone anywhere with those grapes. Why did you pick Oregon?
Because I wanted to make the great American Pinot Noir. And I figured there was no climate cool enough in California to do that.
When did you bottle your first vintage?
1970.
Now, was it in 1975 that you entered the Pinot Noirs into a tasting in France? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes.
Jason,
vintage, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
I can help with some of the dates here. The vintage that was submitted was the 1975.
I see.
But
I see.
The year was 1979.
And what happened with that tasting?
It was amazing. We were in competition with a number of fine Burgundies on the first competition.
Mm-hmm.
And then Robert Drouin called a second competition, and we did even better. We placed second. I think Oregon was made then.
Drouin was a very famous maker of Burgundy.
Yes.
And he called that second tasting, why? Because you had done so well in the first and he wanted to disprove it?
That's right.
Huh.
Right on.
So what happened after this second tasting? What happened here? Did you suddenly have a market for your wines that you hadn't had before?
You're very incisive, yes.
But what was it like for you, personally?
Oh, I was dancing in the driveway. It was fantastic.
I've been told that this may well be the most difficult grape to grow, that it's called the heartbreak grape. It seems to be such a strange choice for someone beginning in the business, making his first wine himself, and choosing a grape that's so demanding.
Well, that was the fun part. Really was. Diana and I were talking a few months ago, and she said, "What would you do if you had this to do all over again?" And I said exactly the same thing. I'd do the same. It was fun. I was starting something new, and I enjoyed it.
What were the biggest challenges with that grape here?
Jason?
Every vintage is a new challenge. That's one of the great things about growing Pinot Noir. It's really expressive of vintage and of the person who makes it and of the place where it's made and every sort of nuance that goes into growing that grape.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole new set of challenges every year, and that's what makes it so fun.
Were there out-and-out failures? I mean, did you have years where it was just impossible for you?
There was 1984, and that was supposed to be an out-and-out failure. Most people didn't even make Pinot Noir that year.
Uh-huh.
They turned it into rosé or something. And I stuck it out and made a red wine out of it, and it's delicious today.
We just had a tasting of every vintage we've done, all 37 vintages. And many of the people at that tasting picked out the 1984 as a favorite from that decade. And so that's a real testament to Dad's ability to adapt to, changing conditions from vintage to vintage.
So the way you make your wine, how do you make Pinot Noir?
Generally speaking, by keeping my hands off of it. I think the grapes are all important. I mean, they're the basis of the expression of the wine. Winemakers can go in and fiddle around and do this and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just going to bugger up the grapes. The best thing to do is leave the grapes alone and let them express themselves under proper growing conditions. We grow good grapes. Jason does a fine job. And he also makes fine wine, which is fortuitous.
I think one of the things that sets our process apart is how intuitive we are. That's certainly what I've learned from him, and that's one of the advantages of being a second-generation winemaker, using the word maker loosely. Is that I can work more intuitively because I've had the experience of working vintages with Dad and seeing the way that he responds to the environment. So I just try to do the same.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see the vineyard.
Absolutely. Well, let's go take a look.
Okay. Jason, I would imagine, did you teethe on a wine bat?
I teethed on a wine cork, that's for sure.
Really? Well, I guess that makes sense.
My kids have too, yeah. my dad used to do a little game with us. He would buy a roll of Lifesavers, and he would hold a Lifesaver in his hand, and we'd have to smell it. And if we could tell him what flavor it was, he'd give it to us. But if we couldn't, he'd eat it.
So how many times did you get it right?
I'm pretty much 100% on Lifesavers now.
So we've got this slope up here covered with vines and the tractor back here that's waiting to do its work. But which vines are these?
These are Pinot Noir vines. And this block here is special to me. It was the last block that we planted at this vineyard. And I got to help do it in 1974. I was 4 years old. And if you look over to the hill beyond, you'll see the original vines, the ones that were planted in 1966.
And of course, they'll produce for a very, very long time yet.
Grapevines are a bit like human beings. You know, as they age, the quality of what they produce goes up and the quantity goes down. And so these vines will continue to produce fruit probably past their 100th year. And what we're going to continue to see as that process happens is an increase in quality and a decrease in quantity. And we're already starting to see this. This vineyard is giving us maybe a ton and a half to the acre every year, but the flavors are concentrated and gorgeous. And so we'll keep farming this long past the time an accountant would tell me to pull it out.
I like to hear that. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you. Good having you here.
That was David Lett, founder of Eyrie Vineyards, and his son Jason, in a piece that we recorded in 2008.